All right, we're back again on Cambridge Inside Out. So again, I'm Robert Winters, and the other guy over there is
Patrick.
This way, that way.
This way, Patrick Barrett.
Mr. Barrett. All right. So we were talking just now, we have a few other topics I definitely want to touch upon here, but one is this sort of, at least for me, is a kind of a recurring concern that in fact, the sort of the salad days of low residential property taxes, because the commercial sector has been bearing it, very heavily, for like to the tune of 2/3, that may be shifting, and largely because of a combination of Prop 2.5, which we have plenty of excess levy capacity, but there are limitations in terms of how you distribute the taxes based on what they call, tax classification, into various sectors with different rates and whatever. And there are certain limitations on how much you can shift onto commercial. And I have a feeling that we're either approaching the minimum we can hit on the residential or the maximum we can hit on the commercial. And that when we hit those either one of those walls, basically the residential sector jumps up. A lot of condo owners will get away, on the cheap. But anybody who's got a single family, two family, even three family are actually going to see not just, $100 increases, but, it could be $500 and more per dollar increases. So anyway, I just think people should at least start to be thinking about things like that. Cambridge is not immune from some of the same fiscal concerns that other towns have, just because we have a lot of golden calves that are
I'd be wary of anyone who says otherwise, Robert. I think that it's been the mantra of a lot of people that we couldn't possibly screw this city up, or that, we could never get so bad that Cambridge is somehow immune to market forces.
But something, Patrick, as I look at those little hand cards and other little gimmies from candidates, I'm calling them, I don't know, I have various names for them all, but basically a lot of it is fiction. Yeah. He has a lot of promises, saying, I believe in this, that, and the other thing. But there is never an acknowledgement of how those things actually come to be, and the kind of money that might be necessary in order to actually make some of these nice ideas happen. So it's very good. It's great to promise. Everybody gets ice cream, right? But somebody still has to pay the bill.
For a budget of $1 billion, actually, everyone probably should get ice cream, Robert. I think that's where I'd love to just audit this budget line for line and trim away about half $1 billion from it. But are we going to have a $2 billion budget someday? Are we going to have is it going to go to $1.1 billion, $1.2 billion, $1.3 billion? We're less than a tenth the size of Boston, who has a $4 billion budget. I mean, that really should raise eyebrows at people in terms of what results.
Well, by the way, we're not a tenth the size of Boston.
We're 6 square miles. They're 90.
Oh no, you're talking about area wise.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking.
How dare you,
population?
No, but like what I'm saying, like just in terms of land mass, like we're. That's what it is. But I think
we're very small, relatively speaking.
It's just kind of amazing to me that we have this capacity. But the counselors who always promise things forget there's 8 other people in the room. But affordable housing, and I say that somewhat facetiously, because if that were truly a priority of the city, just like that sign at the expressway, if you lived here, you'd be home by now. There's plenty of things that we brought to the table that would put plenty of affordable housing on the table that every single one of these councilors has said no to. And the AHO is not the question. That's the one thing they don't have to hold their nose to.
Right. There's it's an awkward position when people, as a candidate now, they ask you, well, what are you going to do about this, that, and the other thing? For example, there are people who are working for the city. I saw a question from somebody yesterday. What would you do for people who are working for the city, who can't afford to live in the city? I said, well, I have a lot of concern about that. But the answer, the correct answer to that question is not what the person wants to hear, which is that, well, you're concerned about people who are working for the city government or teachers or whatever who have a hard time paying for it. But, you know, when people remember the whole EMF debacle, the whole story about the what are we going to do about the artists, a city without artists? We need to dedicate housing just for artists. I said, well, what about dedicating housing for, you know, a lot of other important things like daycare workers and whatever, you know?
I hate to push back on you, Robert, but I'm going to push back on you. I think prioritizing housing for teachers and for city employees, to my mind, seems like a logical thing to do. Prioritize, I mean, give the EMF brats who actually got a great deal, and a lot of them actually got great side deals they didn't tell their friends about, acted in the most reprehensible possible way. They put pictures of my friend John DiGiovanni up all over Central Square with a Hitler mustache.
Those people were
garbage. And I think, you know, that building was also a toilet bowl. And if the city wanted to create an artist collective or artist housing, there'd be something in our zoning that allows for that. There isn't. There'd also be incentives for building it, and there isn't. Right. So when I was looking at the Middle East project, I thought initially, instead of a hotel, or maybe as a hotel with extra floors, put artist lofts up there. But there's no way to get it. There's no incentive. There's no push for it. There's no beneficial zoning. You know, these people talk a good talk, but they do nothing.
Right. My only point really was that, you know, it's sort of a larger economic question.
Yeah.
And if you get down to the point of saying, like, okay, we're going to create housing specifically for this class of people, whether they be artists or teachers or people who work in city departments or whatever, well, you know, we can expand that universe of employed people very broadly. What about carpenters? What about plumbers? You know, why aren't we creating housing for people from all walks of life, rather than not just whether they work for the city or not?
Because carpenters and plumbers are smart enough not to want to live here.
Right. But anyway, my whole point is that the issue of affordability goes way beyond just the specific perks that one city wants to offer for, you know, a particular subset of these workers. Sure. You know, I think the overarching concern about affordability, really, which is a big question nationally. I think it's a big question regionally here, and it's certainly a big question in Cambridge. But I've always said, and again, I'm not saying this to be, you know, flip about it at all, but it's always been to me a question of available options. So, you know, and I said this a month ago with you that once upon a time, somebody wanted to live close to Harvard Square, but they couldn't find a place. So they looked over in some other part of Cambridge, and then they couldn't find something there. So they were able to find a basement apartment somewhere in Cambridge. And then if they couldn't find something in Cambridge, they said, well, maybe I can find something in Somerville or East Arlington. And then back then they could maybe find something. You know, the difficulty now is not a Cambridge specific problem. It's a practice that people now, they've said, well, I was looking for a place in Cambridge, Somerville or Arlington, and they couldn't find it. So now I'm looking in Everett. Now I'm looking in here and there and the other. So the real question to me is, are there options for people? I mean, you know, so, reasonable options, not the kind where you have to hop on a train and travel 2 hours to get to and from where you work, but reasonable options.
It cuts towards housing, single family, two family housing as well. And if you look on the market right now for what's available, inventory is incredibly low for lots of different reasons other than just the lack of supply. There is a significant lack of supply. All everyone says, we're building all the time. Yeah, you know, we need like 20,000 units, not 300. So like, I can't, or the Cambridge is the most dense city in the universe. We couldn't possibly, like, just shut up. I'm so sick of hearing that nonsense.
Well, when I look at it, you know, again, because these days I can't help when I'm walking down the street or driving down the street. God forbid he should drive, right? But I drive sometimes, right?
You should drive. Driving's awesome.
Driving is actually pretty awesome. It's great. It's a great song by Phil Oakes called My Kingdom for a Car. You know? And I'll tell a little story, which is that on Saturday, after sadly, I went up to the service for Denise Simmons's daughter, who had passed away. Denise is really an amazing person. You know, the difficulties she's had to face.
I can't even imagine.
She's something else. But afterwards, I didn't stay for the whole service, but I decided I was going to go for a walk along the Neponset River. You know, and I said, all right, let me be a good doobie. I'm going to hop on the Red Line. And I'm going to get there. Now, you can go on Google Maps and you can get directions. Say, if you hop in a car and go down there and you take, you know, the major roads, you can get there in 18 minutes. I hopped on the Red Line, took me about an hour and 18 minutes. You know, so what's the lesson here? This is that you can say how everybody should take public transportation and that somehow automobiles are a terrible, terrible thing. But when you're faced with 18 minutes versus an hour and 18 minutes, I'm sorry, but you know, you're not going to convince me that automobile is a terrible thing.
Let me add another dimension to that, Robert. I'm a father of two young children. And we've used the T pretty frequently when it comes to going to baseball games for their youth baseball in Boston. And, you know, I won't take my daughter or my son on the T during certain times of day because the behaviors on the T, the smells, the smoking of drugs, I'm not talking about grass. It's not something I want to expose my kids to.
I witnessed all of the above during my little adventure on Saturday, by the way.
So like
I even was at one point where there was one guy who was harassing a woman, and I came this close to basically intervening and probably getting my head handed to me. But
that's the universe weak politicians and socialists are going to bring to you. And I don't mean to get all tinfoil hat on you, but that is their vision of the future. That's what we're fighting in Central Square. That's what we're dealing with. It's a region, as they say, it's a regional issue. It only happens in the regions where these people exist and govern. But when you talk about this is like an endemic of the bigger issues. Like, we don't look at our problems holistically. We don't look at transit, housing, unhoused issues, attic issues, other social issues, and how they all work in tandem with each other. But you have to, in order to be able to solve for any of them, because if you work in the market like I do, you have to be able to produce products that people want to use. So not just you're just creating things because you have infinite money, like a nonprofit, housing developer. They can spend $1 million to a unit and brush it off and go over budget wildly and not even care and build places wherever they want because they have unlimited funding. And they're not subject to budgets. But for the rest of us, we are. And trying to address the supply issue, because there is a massive supply issue, in a place like Cambridge is next to impossible because land acquisition costs, development costs, red tape, and the zoning right now is just, it's anachronistic and doesn't even recognize that there's an issue. But you also need Belmont, Arlington, all these other areas around you to play ball, and they're not. So
right. We'll see what happens with this Housing Choice Act where there's at least some obligation to permit.
Robert, I'm going to tell you right now, there's no obligation. And all you have to do is write a letter to the state proving that your zoning allows for the potential creation of 10,000 units and you're off the hook. Now, that to my mind, it's the same as Dennis Carlone saying, Patrick, max out the zoning citywide and show me what can happen. No, Dennis, because that's dumb. And it's only designed to trigger people. And that's why you asked me to do it. But the reality is that couldn't possibly happen in any universe, not even in the multiverse, Robert, where, you know, I hear people live today, but like there's no universe, Earth 27, that could exist. So it's a pointless exercise. But for the purposes of proving to the state that you comply, I saw the letter that Aram wrote to the state. That's all they had to do. They said,
I know. Well, I mean, part of that is just a recognition of the fact that Cambridge, except for the, you know, I mean, some of the ABC people will lose their mind or lunch over the fact that there's still some single family districts in the city. But for the most part, Cambridge is already a very much a multifamily kind of city.
Yeah.
And so, 92%. It's like hitting a softball, you know, in terms of meeting the criteria of that act.
It's virtue signaling, Robert. It's virtue signaling. It's nonsense. I know, just as much as I hated you hippies from the 60s, I hate these new, whatever the hell they are. In the 23s, everything they have is without substance. So like, you know, get rid of single family housing. It's exclusive zoning and, you know, setbacks are racist. And you're like, I just need you all just to be so quiet and actually listen for a minute. And develop a zoning plan that actually works. They don't want to.
You
do
know,
that.
I'm sure this will make me no friends with the ABC crowd. But
it makes you no friends hanging out with
and
me.
And by the way, this coming Saturday there is like multiple candidate, kind of a joint candidate event, and unfortunately it's in Zoom for a bunch of the organizations. And then the ABC group is on the following Tuesday, so a week from today, over at the Foundry. You know, so it'll be kind of interesting. But you know, they're basically only want to tolerate people who are in 100% agreement with them.
Yeah.
So for example, I mean, I happen to be a person who feels that the city is actually enriched by the diversity of housing styles and choices around the city. I like the fact that there are some really kind of beautiful, amazing buildings that are yes, they may be single family, but they're also fabulous, and it's a great thing. And I also like the fact that there are some neighborhoods that are, you know, chock-a-block, all dense too. But you know, we can be a lot of things. You don't have to be one standard based on some ideology.
I find that these ideologues are particularly joyless. They don't see they derive their joy, it seems, from either finding ways to segregate people, or based on ideas or race or whatever, or martyring themselves. And that seems to be their only two sources of happiness.
Well, you know, I think I would liken it a little bit to the French Revolution crowd, where, you know, it's sort of like we have decided who the aristocrats are, and we have to, you know, go off with their heads. And mind you, listen, I've been around Cambridge long enough, and I've been to some of the tonier parts of town and some of the less, you know, fancy parts of town as well. It's all good. You know, there's no terrible parts of Cambridge anymore. It's fine. But this notion that somehow because a person is living in a single family home in one of those parts of town, that they somehow need to be brought, you know, put in the back of a cart and rolled up to the guillotine is to me really offensive.
To me, they seem like a bunch of Maoists. And I know that's going to get me in even more trouble, but like it's like a cultural revolution, but cultural revolution light. Cause I don't think they have the cojones to really drag me out of my house. I wish they did. Sometimes I would revel in that fight,
One other point I was going to make though, is that you have over the years, maybe because there were some former industrial zones, which are rapidly disappearing. I mean, I think what the last frontier is the quadrangle, which I do not like when people call it the quad, like these little Princeton grads referring to the quadrangle. It's the quad.
Isn't that where you hit the hacky sack?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We play hacky sack out in the quad. Yeah. But it was called the quadrangle. It was the Alewife triangle, the Alewife quadrangle. If you actually read a little bit about the history of, you know, studies for developable sites, you'd know all of this language, you know. So you can tell the people who don't know much from just their language half the time. But the thing is that those were places that were former industrial. They weren't going to be manufacturing the same kind of heavy manufacturing that once existed. So they were perfect sites to be repurposed into housing sites. And that really did happen in great ways. So we were able to produce, you know, really thousands and thousands of units of housing, basically by making use of sites which were really no longer industrial. And then they were really great for doing housing development, you know. And you know, one of the things, I'm sure you know this one, but I wrote a little essay. It was a little photo essay some years ago. It was called what was it called? It was like Central Square. It was a square, you know, it's like Completing the Square, I called it. And it was basically just an opportunistic walk through Central Square with a camera, taking pictures of little low-scale buildings that were little one stories, and saying, you know, this really there should be something more here.
Yeah.
You know, now if people in the city, the community development department, and if city councilors would spend a little bit of time just walking and saying, you know, this could use some more.
Robert,
this
you're
is
too,
probably
you're too kind, you're too generous, because they have walked through.
But what they do is they come in with this sort of top-down thing, like their various versions of the affordable housing overlay. By the way, AHO 2.0, if that doesn't fly, they'll make AHO 3.0. And, you know, I don't know where the hell they're going to be going.
AHO 2.0 is guaranteed to pass. Guaranteed.
Right. Which to me is a real shame, because to me, this is not an answer. This is a top-down approach to something that should be done much more thoughtfully.
It's a sidestep to actually addressing the problem. The council gets to congratulate themselves for being woker than woke by approving the only affordable housing is the only housing that's worthy of being built at 12 to 15 stories. They completely ignore their own plans they've had on the table for decades for Central Square. And, you know, the in an election season, the ABC kids get to flap their flippers and throw them a sardine. To the tune of counselors who, for no reason at all, have decided to bring this to the table because according to them, affordable housing developers are having a difficult time building things. And it's nonsense. It's total fabricated nonsense. Kudos to the few affordable housing developer guys. I know those guys had to show up and, you know, support this thing because they owe their allegiances. But like, none of them asked for this. None of them. So like that we're doing this and this is our housing strategy. This is where CBD needed to step in and say, guys, this is how we do it.
This is where CDD of years past should step in, but that's not CDD of times present.
No, but that's,
I was actually speaking with a person who was once head of the community development department, who basically laid it out, you know, a little gathering a week or so ago, about, you know, how in fact we've been heading in exactly the wrong direction. We've basically are disemboweling 20 years of good planning that was coming out of the community development department in terms of scattered site affordability of housing and getting it better distributed. And now they're basically just throwing all that away in favor of basically doing concentrated tall buildings of that are specifically, quote, 100% affordable for whatever the hell that even means anymore. You know, so, you know, I've really lost a lot of faith in the people within the community development department in terms of certainly housing planning.
It's an interesting subject that I've been getting more and more information about because it's not really my specialty. But it used to be that a public housing was the city built and that it was tax exempt. And now what we have is really a private investment collaboration with the groups like Cambridge Housing Authority and other affordable developers, and they are no longer tax exempt, but they have to go to the city every year and look for abatements to try to limit their tax liability. So like
there's one other wrinkle, because, you know, I see it when I look at the assessor's database, which is that all of these properties have deed restrictions. And a property with a deed restriction basically is going to be assessed at like 1/6 a market.
Deal. But that's the point. So like if you're an investor, as a private investor in these groups, you need those assessments to go way down to start with. You need to limit your tax liability for those buildings because that eats into your profit. So like where affordable housing was once this sort of public, city funded, federally funded, state funded thing, it's now a private, it's been privatized to some degree. And that, to my mind, for all these people who are these housing advocates and this democratic socialists and whatever, whoever the hell you are, that you believe in no profit, that's what this whole thing is.
But you know, there was a very nice study that I read recently, came out of Somerville, you know, because there was the people who were promoting this whole summer vision, you know, notion about how they were rewriting their zoning and everything like that, because everybody wants more and more housing.
Yeah, and
it basically made. But he basically, the author made the point, and I think it's an unfortunate but accurate fact that when you build just the housing, that, you know, and then you've got also, if the person has children, you have to take them to schools, whatever, you actually end up, it actually costs you as a city in terms of revenue for doing that. So he's basically making the point that if you want to have a balanced plan, you have to promote some commercial development in order to basically cover the costs of the housing that you're building.
You need commercial development. You need lab development in particular. Anyone who's telling you otherwise is a joke and a liar. Lab is the new name for what we call office. You need market rate housing. But That you need, and it's a balance. It's not one or the other or all in the same. And that's where these people have, and I'm not sure. I know who you were talking to, but like, that's right. They've gutted that balance, and now you've got a completely ad hoc broken system that's eventually going to cave in on itself.
Right. I mean, the thing is, you have to use principles about finance in order to balance this out and make sure that the entire system that you're proposing is actually economically sustainable. Right. And the thing is, if you want to, you know, basically, you know, be taking the aristocrats up to the guillotine, you know, and you think, well, but we're just going to take your property and tax you, you know, and have your property tax go up $1,000 a year, every one of you, or more. Actually, that might even be lowballing it, you know, just to kind of cover the costs of some of the, this development. You know, they have to acknowledge the fact that, well, if you really wanted to balance out, you're going to have to do something like allowing commercial development. So at some point, you have to make some decisions here, some hard decisions. Do you want that much commercial development? You know, because if you don't, then maybe you have to have a little bit, you know, sort of tender your aspirations in terms of some of the housing development and basically say, well, what kind of city do you want? You know, and but just saying it's just all, you know, it's all for one ideal is really, well, stupid. It's just stupid.
I like to say to my DSA friends and my ABC friends who are listening tonight who have only been offended by everything I've said, I invite you to lighten up and try to find some joy out of life other than the terrible nonsense that you spew on Twitter or everywhere else where it seems to be.
You know, it's actually I'll take that not only out of the DSA crowd, which are some of the most humorless people I've ever met in my life, but also some of the cycling advocates. I'm thinking, you know, do you, if you're spending your entire life with a camera strapped to your helmet so that you can record somebody's license plate so you can report them and see quick fix because you're mad because they stopped for 2 minutes to let their kids off in a bike lane. I said, you know, you've got some serious problems and I think you need to have a little more fun in life.
I think what they all need to do is go have some kids. That'll take the spark out of your seat.
Maybe so. Anyway, we're just about out of time here, Patrick. So this has been fun as always. So anyway, right. I encourage everybody to learn about all the candidates, not just me, you know, and, you know, pay attention. We've got a big year ahead. Okay. So see you soon on Cambridge Inside Out.